This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. A report released last week amounts to an indictment of America's prison system as overcrowded, violent, expensive, unhealthy, and counterproductive. More than 13 million people spend time in the American correctional system each year, the report says. 95% are eventually released. 60% find their way back after committing another crime. The Commission on Safety and Abuse in America's Prisons gathered a distinguished panel that included a former attorney general, a former director of the FBI, former wardens, prosecutors, other veterans of criminal justice, who conclude that the U.S. prison system is on the brink of collapse. Yet many of the Commission's findings are not news. There have been any number of reports about overcrowded and dangerous prisons, and while the Commission presented its conclusions and recommendations to the Senate Judiciary Committee last week, it's not clear what, if anything, will come of that. Also, most Americans continue to support longer sentences and vote for get-tough policies like three strikes and you're out. We'll talk with the executive director of the study and with a critic of the report. Later in the program, some good news for the White House as a federal prosecutor decides not to indict the president's chief political advisor. But first, the state of America's prisons. If you work or have worked in the correctional system, we'd like to hear your thoughts. What's wrong? What's right? Is prison reform an issue? Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. Joining us now is Alex Busansky. He's executive director of the Commission on Safety and Abuse in America's Prisons, and he's kind enough to join us today here in Studio 3A. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Is the brink of collapse the kind of hyperbole that people use to bring attention to blue ribbon studies, or is it justified in your view?
I think it's the hyperbole that people bring. I don't think in our report we say that it's on the brink of collapse. What we say is that there are challenges, serious challenges for our jails and prisons. But there are success stories. There are 750,000 men and women who work in corrections in America. The vast, vast majority of them come to work every day wanting to and doing the right thing with the tools and the resources that we give them. But we, our legislators and the public, have to give them more. There are 2.2 million people in jail and prison today. There are millions and millions who go through the system every year, and almost all of them, in excess of 95%, are getting out at some point. And those men and women who work are coming home at the end of the day. And we have to understand that we need to be responsible for both issues of public safety and public health, that what happens inside of our jails and prisons has implications both on the inside, but it doesn't stay inside our jails and prisons and impacts all of us.
Mm-hmm. You use that 2.2 million figure of people in prisons and jails right now. I think that just came out last week, and it showed that the prison population had doubled over the course of, 15 years.
In the last 30 years, it's actually increased by almost tenfold. We were once down around 200,000 around 30 or so years ago. But notwithstanding that increase, we have an obligation and a responsibility to each individual that we incarcerate. And society can decide to do what they want. But we can't crowd our facilities to the point of a breaking where violence and other problems become almost inevitable. We have to make sure that we fund medical and mental health care inside of facilities for every individual. And we have to understand that public safety and public health doesn't end at the jailhouse door. It's something that continues inside and outside of our jails and prisons.
Yet there seems to be, if your reforms are to be enacted, you've got a lot of public education to do. People continue to vote for things like three strikes and you're out.
People continue to do it, and they will continue to do it until they begin to make that connection. People have to understand that we can see jail and prison as a place where people go when they're sentenced for their offense. But it's also a place of opportunity. It's a place where we can address serious medical issues, particularly communicable diseases like HIV, tuberculosis, and hepatitis, things that impact everybody inside and will be carried with them on the outside unless we do something. We have to look at the issue of programming and productivity. What is it we want people to be doing while they're inside? We all know that if we don't give people something to do, they're going to be destructive instead of constructive. If you give people something to do inside, everyone agrees it makes it for a safer and less abusive environment. But it also gives them a better chance of being successful on the outside. Right now, nationally, the recidivism rate is over 60%. The reincarceration rate is over 50%. We need to do more with public safety, and we need to do more with public health.
Let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. Our number is 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. And let's turn to Jackie. Jackie calling from Drummond in Wisconsin.
Yes, I was just really excited about this program all day. I planned my day to call you. I retired in, was it 1990? County Jail in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And I worked there for 20 years as a nurse. And I must say that we gave good medical care and we were accredited. But every day I came to work and I looked into the faces of all these people who were incarcerated and kept getting incarcerated, who as younger people were given no life skills as to conscience, you know, how to behave, how to make a living. And I concur that we need to have these people back out, but I just am very pessimistic, and I think what we have to do is start with the 14, 15, and 16-year-olds and have some compulsory place where they go if they don't have any goals when they get out, because these people are they have a hopelessness to them, and it makes more sense to be a low-grade drug dealer than working at McDonald's. And one other thing we're going to say, in my community we had a big drug bust on the Indian Reservation, and this just devastated families, so now we're into trying to work with community corrections. In fact, there's a meeting tonight about that in Wisconsin. So I think, you know, there are a lot of creative things we have to do, but we have to realize that a lot of these people, you know, have really not developed the skills to go back into a neighborhood and not plague that neighborhood. Your inner cities are plagued, you know, with petty crime. Petty crime gets you more than murders. And so I want, you know, I'm concur with all this, but I'm somewhat a liberal pessimist, and I hope you can make me a little bit more hopeful.
Is liberal pessimism justified?
I don't believe so, nor does the commission. This is not a commission, as you said at the beginning, of liberal tree huggers, and it's not a bunch of corrections insiders who wear rose-colored glasses and say everything is all right, leave us alone. These are individuals who work in and around the profession, who see the problems, see the challenges, but also see the opportunities. There is a light at the end of the tunnel. Many places are reaching it every day. The caller mentioned that her facility was accredited. Right now, nationally, only 43% of our prisons are accredited, and only 4% of our jails, and that's by the American Corrections Association. We need more facilities to be accredited, and we need to make sure that our accreditation standards and the standards that are used are meaningful. And we talk about that in our report.
Okay. Jackie, thanks very much for the call. Let's turn now to Dr. Rick Dudley. The commission report, among other things, focused on the quality of medical and mental health care provided to prisoners. Although prisoners are one of the few groups guaranteed health care by law, the report found rampant medical neglect. Dr. Dudley joins us from our bureau in New York City. Nice to have you with us today.
Nice to be here.
One reason for medical neglect was the ratio of doctors to inmates. How bad was it in some prisons?
Well, certainly varied from prison to prison and from jail to jail, but in some of the worst situations we heard about where you'd have like one doctor for thousands of inmates, where the doctor really just had an impossible task to adequately cover. And then not only that, that same doctor then having inadequate access to specialists and specialty care when that was required only made the matters worse.
And particularly, you looked at the issue of mental health care as well and concluded that there were disturbingly high levels of mental illness in the inmate population.
That's right. Everyone's quite clear about the fact that with the closing of state mental health facilities and that the jails really have and the prisons have now had a dramatic increase in mentally ill prisoners. Mm-hmm. And so they've ended up doing what the state hospitals are not doing. And, you know, they're not state hospital facilities. Many of them do not have adequate staff to handle the load of inmates who suffer from mental illnesses. Mm-hmm. In the most conservative estimates that we saw, talking really about a limited population, those with serious persistent mental illnesses like schizophrenia or major depression with suicidality, it was like 16%. And then when you included other really debilitating psychiatric disorders, like people who had been traumatized and were suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, people who have substance abuse problems and psychiatric problems all at the same time, when you add these other populations in who, again, have debilitating psychiatric difficulties, estimates go up to like 40% and 50%. So, I mean, you know, the prisons just can't manage that load. They don't have the kind of staff that they need. They don't have the kind of special facilities that they need in adequate numbers, like acute psychiatric beds. They don't have the kind of transitional programs for people who maybe don't need an acute psychiatric bed but need some more protected environment to become more stable. Most of them don't have special substance abuse programs for people who have substance abuse problems and mental health problems, despite the fact that it's so clear that people who suffer from these dual problems need special programs mm-hmm. that deal with the mental health problems and the substance abuse problems at the same time. So it's just an impossible task.
It's an impossible task. Is the solution to provide a lot more money, to provide the kind of facilities and resources you're talking about? And remember, politically, this may be needed, but there are a lot of people on the outside who need all those facilities and don't get anybody to pay for them either.
Well, the commission found that there are several issues and several things that need to be addressed. Certainly, it didn't get past us that one of the big problems is that we need more community mental health services in the community mm-hmm. so that people who suffer from mental health problems have access to treatment as opposed to just kind of being out there, not being treated, not being able to function, and ending up being arrested and ending up at the doors of our jails and prisons. Second, it's clear that those who do end up at the doors of our jails and prisons need to be adequately screened. So that people who do suffer from mental health problems can be identified and directed in the right way. We saw some very exciting sorts of programs around this issue of screening and the attempt to triage people who suffer from mental illnesses into different types of programming, either outside of the prison where they may be most appropriately, or outside of the jail where they may be most appropriately helped, or even if they do require incarceration, into the programs that exist within the system. So we saw some very exciting interventions there. Certainly we need more staff in areas where they're understaffed with mental mm-hmm. health professionals, particularly more staff who are ethnoculturally competent, who have the skills to treat the population that we see there.
Dr. Dudley, I'm afraid we're out of time, but we thank you for joining us today. Dr. Rick Dudley, a psychiatrist and one of the commissioners on the report. He joined us today from our bureau in New York. When we come back, we'll continue talking with Alex Busansky, executive director of the commission, and we'll be joined by a critic of the report. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. A report released last week says our prisons are overcrowded and violent, and what's more, the $60 billion we spend on these prisons every year is misspent, that this money goes to waste in many cases. Our guest is Alex Busansky, executive director of the Commission on Safety and Abuse in America's Prisons. Of course, you're invited to join us. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is talk@npr.org. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Reginald. Reginald calling us from Baltimore in Maryland.
Hello. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Okay. I was a former correctional officer, and I spent over 20 years working in the system, and I can tell you that the system will only work when people decide that they spend the money that people are worth saving. That mental health, it comes to the point where it really has it's a choice of whether or not you want to spend the money and save a person, or keep spending the money down a black hole and perpetuate all kinds of stereotypes and perpetuate a system that doesn't rehabilitate anyone.
Alex Busansky, is he right?
He's right. Public safety and public health. If we don't spend the money to diagnose and treat individuals and to take care of them and to link them up with public health institutions, we're going to see the same behavior manifest itself in ways that we as a society disapprove of, and they're going to find themselves right back in the very jail or prison that they came from.
Well, let's bring another voice into the conversation. I'm sorry, Reginald, go ahead.
I wanted to say one other thing. Like, do you remember over 100 years ago when the country was going west and it was the frontier, and if a person went to jail, when he came out of jail, he was given a fresh start. For the most part, that's what happened then. But now there's no fresh starts for people. Mental health and people who are incarcerated are stigmatized to the point where they're virtually treated like lepers. And now we got a bunch of people walking around who are not employable, not because they don't want to be employed, but because no one will not give them the chance because of stereotypes.
You mean about felons that don't want to hire ex-cons?
Right.
All right. Reginald, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
We'll get a critic of the report on now. Martin Horn is a commissioner of the New York City Department of Correction, and he joins us from our bureau in New York City. Nice to have you with us.
Thank you, Neil.
And what are your problems with this survey?
I think that I'm really disappointed more than a critic. I think that this was a lost opportunity to say something profound. Much of what is in the report has been said before. As far back as 1987, the American Correctional Association, which was spoken about earlier, made recommendations concerning the very things that are contained in the recommendations here. I also feel that despite protestations to the contrary, and I think your introduction proves my point, that it perpetuates the demonization of inmates. You introduced this segment of mm-hmm. your program as saying that America's prisons were on the brink of disaster, that hundreds of thousands of people are released with contagious diseases. Just introducing the second part, you said America's prisons are overcrowded and violent. You described the report as an indictment, saying that prisons are violent and unhealthy. Those things are simply untrue. The fact is that over the last 20 years, despite the growth in the prison population, which we would like to talk about and which certainly is deplorable, nonetheless, America's prisons and jails have gotten remarkably safer. They are indeed perhaps the safest prisons and jails anywhere in the world, certainly in a country as large and diverse as ours. I think that they compare favorably to European prisons.
Well, let's get a response from Alex Busansky. Your report concludes, violence remains a serious problem, a disturbing evidence of individual assaults and patterns of violence in some U.S. prisons and jails.
Violence is an issue in too many jails and prisons, and it's an issue in jails and prisons if it's not being addressed appropriately. One of the real shortcomings in our system that we found as a commission is that we just don't have enough information. Jails and prisons are public institutions, just like our public schools and our public hospitals. We can compare the public school in Washington, D.C. with a public school in California or Oklahoma. We cannot compare the public jail in D.C. with other public jails around this country on issues of safety and abuse. Mm-hmm. Alan Beck from the Bureau of Justice Statistics says the same things. We just don't have the reporting information, and that means that we get into conversations based on stories, my successful story about what happened in a facility versus your unsuccessful story. And we need to surface that information so that we can reward those leaders and those institutions that are doing a good job and that we can appropriately identify those that are failing and those that are flagging and give them the additional resources and help that they need. But I disagree with Commissioner Horn. This is not some old set of recommendations that has been dusted off and a new jacket has been put on it. This is a diverse set of recommendations that speaks to a whole range of issues that groups like the American Corrections Association and others have not tackled. We recommend the abolishment of medical copays, which is the standard in the majority of prisons in this country. We call for the repeal of the prohibition on seeking Medicaid and Medicare funding. We have strong recommendations on the issue of oversight and accountability, both internal and external, and we tackle this issue of data and knowledge. In addition, we look at those specific conditions of confinement, like segregation and the medical problems.
Commissioner Horn?
Well, first of all, there may well be one or two recommendations that haven't been addressed by the profession, but most of them already have. On the issue of Medicaid, the fact is that as far back as the year 2000, correspondence was going back and forth between the profession and indeed between the Department of Health and Human Services concerning the provision of Medicaid. There was correspondence with Donna Shalala and with Tommy Thompson as far back as 2000. Asking that Medicaid be provided for inmates leaving prisons and jails, which is among the recommendations in the report. I think that the more important fact is that the profession has certainly recognized that violence has to be dealt with. The same thing that Alex says about the statistics could be said about the prevalence of crime in our society. We don't know for sure how many robberies there are, but we have certain standards that we count. We know, for example, that murders are well counted. We know that car thefts are well counted. The same is true in prisons and jails. We might not know every time inmate A assaults inmate B, but we do know when homicides occur. We do know when suicides occur. And the fact is that the decline has been dramatic over the last 20 years. Inmates come into prison safe and they leave safe. Inmates, to the extent that there is disease, and God knows, I'll take a backseat to no one in terms of the need to use prison as an opportunity to promote public health. But the fact is that the diseases that they have, they brought with them. And to suggest that prison fuels it or that prison creates contagion, I think is certainly misleading.
All right, let's get some listeners on the line. Let's get Jason. Jason's with us from Reading, Pennsylvania.
Hello.
Hi, Jason.
Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly don't mean to disrespect the judgments of these, obviously much more intelligent individuals than me, but I just respectfully submit that I think we're missing the point of prisons. I think that there's the prisons. The point of prisons is punishment. It's to engage in X behavior, and this is the consequence. People talk about how the death penalty is not a deterrent. Well, we do it so infrequently. Even if you're sentenced to death, you're probably not going to get executed. That's why it's not a deterrent. If we have a problem with violence, well, if we kept the violent criminals in their cells, they couldn't hurt other people. If we made prison as humane, certainly humane, but unpleasant as possible, so they are punished for the period of time that, then when they reenter society, I don't mean to lecture, but society is a contract. If you engage in certain behaviors, you obey our laws and everything. In exchange for that, obeying the laws, paying your taxes, you get social services and protections by the government and the military. They violated that contract. There needs to be consequences for that. When that bill is settled, then we can talk about re-education, things like that. But mm-hmm. to give them weights and books.
Jason, let's get a response. First from Commissioner Horn. Is punishment the purpose?
The incarceration itself is the punishment, Neil. We don't send people to prison to inflict any additional punishment on them. In our society, the separation from family is the punishment. The loss of personal autonomy is the punishment. I think that we have to develop in this country a standard of care that recognizes that the individuals in prison are other people's children and that we should expect them to be treated as we would have our own children treated. I think that every parent has the right to expect that their child returns from prison or jail no worse than they entered. And I think that since we refer to our system as a correction system, we ought to be about correcting individuals. Now, that's hard. That's a very nuanced task to take on, especially in America's prisons. And I want to go back to the conversation that you had with Dr. Dudley. In this country, America's jails have become the first responders to mental illness. In New York City, we probably provide more acute mental health care at Rikers Island in our jails than is provided in the state's hospitals and the city's hospitals. And while we're in New York City and we have the benefit of Bellevue and a very, very robust psychiatric community, if you are the sheriff of a rural jail, you are very, very sorely tested by the presence of the mentally ill in your jails. There may not even be a psychiatrist within the county. One of the failings of the report, I think, is that it fails to differentiate between the challenges faced by small jurisdictions and small jails, mm-hmm. many of which employ part-time staff, and the large state jurisdictions and the large urban jail systems. I think that it's a very hard thing to generalize about. Every prison and jail is unique, and just as with radio stations, some are good and some are not as good. And I think that one of the things that I certainly would have liked to have seen more of in the report was data that distinguished between the systems that were doing well and the systems that were doing poorly. And I think that the data does exist. In fact, exemplars mm-hmm. of it were provided to the commission, and I was very, very saddened that they chose to ignore them.
Well, let's get a response to that from Alex Busansky.
I think that Marty and I agree that prisons and jails need to be as safe as possible and need to, if possible, correct individuals and to help them and to help public safety and to help public health. This report is the work of 20 commissioners from a diverse set of backgrounds who looked at these issues, people on the left and right, conservative, Democrat, Republican, Christian, people in corrections and out of corrections, and they came to agreement about a whole host of issues. we need to understand that there are common challenges. When we were having our fourth hearing in Los Angeles, it was the same week that the jail was under lockdown because of massive riots. We heard from Pearl Beal, a mother of a young African-American boy here in the district, who was in pending trial on a nonviolent offense, who was murdered while in jail, and there was no one around to see what happened. This is the same jail that Judith Miller from the New York Times asked a federal judge not to send her to because it was overcrowded and unsafe and dangerous. And the federal judge agreed and sent her to a jail outside of D.C. If the District of Columbia jail, and it's not a small jail, isn't safe enough for Judith Miller, it's not safe enough for Pearl Beal, an African-American woman and her African-American son. I agree with Marty that we should have jails and prisons that are places that we would feel that our loved ones and our family members can go to safely and return from no worse off. But that is not the case everywhere. There are plenty of success stories, and we have them. Mm-hmm. New York does some good things. Other jurisdictions do some good things. But we need to do more, and we're trying to help.
We're talking about the state of America's prisons, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And here's an email we got from a woman who asked that we not use her name. I work in a medium security prison in North Carolina that serves young men ages 18 to 25. There's one segment of our population that no program addresses. This is the group that will probably never be able to get a GED, and therefore they do not qualify for many of the programs designed to help with job skills. Vocational rehabilitation was pulled from most prisons in North Carolina. Was this need addressed by the panel? What about training programs designed to train inmates for skilled labor? Was that mentioned, Alex Busansky?
Yes, we talk about in our report that we need to have more programming. We need to have more opportunities for people to be productive. It may be a drug treatment program. It may be an educational program. It may be a job skill, learning how to lay carpet, learning how to do electrical work. There's lots of opportunities. But what is clear is that what's happened in North Carolina has happened around the country, as the commission heard over and over again, is that we have taken those types of programs out that not only make people better, that reduce recidivism, but also give people something to do every day. We heard from correction leaders, people like Don Cabana, who used to run the maximum security prison in Parchman, Mississippi. We heard from Ron McAndrew, who ran the maximum security prison in Florida. We heard from correction officials around the country. They all want programming. It's good for the institution, it's good for the people, and it's good for society.
Mm-hmm. Get a response from Martin Horn, Commissioner?
Certainly, all responsible correction professionals believe that programming is the best way to manage an institution, again, because the name of our profession is correction. It's not punishment. I think the unfortunate reality is that the decisions are made by elected officials. And if this is an indictment of anyone, it is an indictment of elected officials at the federal as well as at the state level. And it gets to a very fundamental question of democracy. Do the people of the state, and I think one of the callers, perhaps it was Reginald, who called in, and these legislatures reflect the will of the people. They are called upon to make difficult choices in difficult fiscal circumstances. And I think that it is somewhat anti-democratic to impose upon them an obligation to fund these programs before they fund adequate drug treatment in the community. Frankly, I would like to see funding for adequate mental health care in the community such that it prevents large numbers of the mentally ill from entering our jails. So there's a fundamental political choice to be made here, and unfortunately it's made by elected officials.
Alex Busansky, that question of resources comes up again and again and again.
And it's the right question to ask. But we are paying money. As you said, we're spending over $60 billion. It's not a question of a willingness to pay. The question is, when do we want to pay and how do we want to pay? If we can reduce recidivism, if we can reduce reincarceration, if we can improve public health, that saves money. If I was the district attorney in a town, if I was the commissioner of public health, I would go to my local jail or prison and I'd say, what can we do together? What can we do to improve public safety and public health? And that saves money. And I think that in places that have done that, you see an electorate that responds positively to that. Because people, when they're educated and they understand that what happens inside of jail and prison, it's not a free zone. You can't just pretend there are no consequences for what happens. You find that people want that. And we talk about this in our report, and we have examples from around the country.
Martin, Horn, the last 30 seconds is yours. Yeah.
Sure. The fact is that the public health officials don't come asking to do it. The fact is that the district attorneys don't come asking to do it. And the fact is that in 15 months of work, 20 commissioners managed to visit two prisons and one jail in the entire country.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. If you'd like to read the full report, you can go to our website. It's at the Talk of the Nation page at npr.org. Commissioner Horn, thank you for your time today. We know you're busy. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Martin Horn, Commissioner of the New York City Department of Corrections. Our thanks, too, to Alex Busansky, Executive Director of the Commission on Safety and Abuse in America's Prisons, who was with us here in our bureau in Washington, our studio in Washington. That's what we call it. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having us.
When we come back from a short break, NPR political editor Ron Elving joins us to explain what it means now that Karl Rove will not face charges, will not be going to jail in the CIA leak case. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.